You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's time for us to set the day's agenda. Our Hong Kong Bureau Chief Aisha Spears joins us on the line. Aisha, what have you got for us?
Today we're going to be talking about the ongoing unpopularity of Hong Kong's chief executive, a new study in air pollution, and a theft at one of the city's top hotels.
Also coming up on the program...
Go into that battle with a full knowledge that this is a do-or-die struggle.
Election season gets underway in Zimbabwe as both President Robert Mugabe and Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai set out their opposing stalls ahead of Election Day on July 31st.
Our faith in God and our collective desire for real transformation will make us triumph over the setbacks we have experienced.
We will be discussing what's at stake later on in the show. Also coming up... That is the sound of our warming world. We'll speak to the composer who transposed the globe's rising temperature, turned it into a musical score.
What probably the most important aspect of the piece is hearing the progression of the notes and keeping in mind that it's representing change in time.
All that, plus we'll check in with our correspondent in Istanbul. We'll head to Indonesia's newest enclave for contemporary design, and we'll play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So it's 8:02 a.m. here in London. That makes it time to catch up with your news headlines with Paul Osborne.
A leaked Pakistani government report highlights incompetence and negligence, which it says allowed Osama bin Laden to live undetected in the country for almost a decade. It found no evidence that officials inside government were complicit in concealing bin Laden's whereabouts, but questioned why earlier US concerns that he could be in the country were dismissed. The report also describes the US raid to kill bin Laden as an act of war and Pakistan's greatest humiliation. Egypt's interim president has set out a timetable for new elections as unrest continues following the military's move to oust Mohamed Morsi. At least 51 people have died in violence in the capital, Cairo, when the army moved to end a sit-in by members of the Muslim Brotherhood. Adli Mansour's plan calls for changes to Egypt's constitution, with elections due early next year. The United States has urged Egypt's transitional authorities to calm the situation. White House spokesman Jay Carney.
I think it would not be in the best interest of the United States to immediately change our assistance programs to Egypt. We think, not just I, but we think that it would not be in the best interest of the United States to do that. We are reviewing our obligations under the law, and we will be consulting with Congress about the way forward with regards to specifically the assistance package that we provide.
It could be several days before search teams in Canada can access the entire disaster zone after a train carrying crude oil derailed and exploded in Quebec. 13 people are now confirmed dead in Lac Megantic, but police spokesman Bernard Wichert warns that around 40 more are still missing.
Hopefully that's a pretty good, that's a pretty accurate number, but that's still undergoing in part of the investigation. If anybody has information as to somebody that's in Canada and has been missing, call the consulate here in Canada and have them talk to us.
Meanwhile, a heavy rainstorm in Toronto has left more than a quarter of a million people without power. Parts of Canada's largest city have been flooded after more than a month's average rain fell in just one day. The rebel M23 movement to the Democratic Republic of Congo is stepping up recruitment, but denying claims that it's forcing adults and children to fight. It's reinforcing positions around the city of Goma after clashes with the army. The first phase of a UN intervention force has now moved into the region, but rebels say they will treat the soldiers as enemies. And Kimimana Emmanuel is a new recruit to the rebels.
There is no other solution. We have to fight and to restore a good government. When dignity in Congo will be the rule, a Congolese find himself in his country as a citizen.
Japan is warning it faces increasingly serious threats to its security from China and North Korea. A new report says the country's military must improve its ability to respond to foreign threats. Japan and China are still engaged in a dispute over rival claims to tiny islands in the East China Sea. The US has again warned it could pull all its troops out of Afghanistan next year. Initial plans included a small force to support Afghan troops once international combat forces leave the country. But officials have admitted that relations between the US and Afghanistan have worsened since America moved to start peace talks with the Taliban. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. It is 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You are indeed listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Well, it is now time for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Joining us today on the line is our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. Aisha, welcome to the program. Where should we begin today?
Let's begin with CY Leung, who is the chief executive here and seems to constantly be under fire from the people that he is supposed to be governing. July 1st, we saw the big protests going through the city, many of them calling for his resignation, and another hit now for CY Leung. Johannes Chan, who's the dean of the law faculty here at the University of Hong Kong, a leading academic in the city, has said that CY Leung should indeed step down.
Get us up to speed on exactly why there is so much apparent unhappiness with CY Leung's ruling.
Well, he's only been in office for a year. He was he came into office on July 1st last year, so it has been a pretty quick downfall for him. There's a number of things which people are saying. They think that he's a puppet of Beijing. He's feared to be a communist. People don't trust his inner circle of ministers. And there's also been a huge issue of universal suffrage. We're coming up to 16 years since the handover. There's still no sign that there will be universal suffrage for Hong Kongers. On top of that, on a more day-to-day situation, the cost of living in Hong Kong is getting higher and higher, the difference between rich and poor is getting worse in the city, and lots of people are thinking CY Leung is doing absolutely nothing to combat any of those issues.
And indeed, we did see those massive protests on July 1st. CY Leung's approval ratings at record low. Is there any sense that Beijing is starting to sense this discontent and they're planning on perhaps doing something about it?
Beijing yet haven't said anything, and I'm not sure that they would. But it does seem that more people in Hong Kong who have something to do with the government, who had something to do with the government in the past, are saying that CY Leung should step down. It's moved now from a simple kind of discontent in the streets to officials saying that it would be sensible for him to get rid of all the tension in the city and step down. He hasn't announced that he'll do anything. There's been no real response from his camp on that.
Is there an alternative waiting in the wings, and what might they be able to do differently?
I'm sure everyone wants an alternative who's a little bit closer to the Hong Kong 2020 group, who are pushing for political reform, and they're the people. There's a big protest planned next year asking for universal suffrage. So I guess there's hopes that whoever will come into leadership here, if there is a change, will be someone who will fight more for Hong Kong and less for Beijing. But that's unlikely to happen, seeing as it's someone who is put in position by Beijing.
And Aisha, tell us how that part of the world is reacting, moving on to another story, to that horrible crash in San Francisco of the Air Asiana flight.
Well, of course, as with everywhere, it's front page news here. And here the angle is, sadly, it's more of a regional story. Of course, the two fatalities from the crash were Chinese teenagers from Zhejiang province. And there's been outrage across the region because of a South Korean TV host who apparently has really offended people in both China and in South Korea by saying that it was a relief that the two fatalities that resulted from the crash were Chinese as opposed to Korean. Channel A News agency, who the presenter was representing, have issued an apology to the Chinese people through South Korea's embassy in China. But there's been all sorts of reaction online asking for Yoon Kyon-ming, the presenter, to resign.
The pictures were, of course, around the world instantly. They were pretty shocking, and that tends to have an effect on share prices. I presume that there has been a bit of a hit taken.
Indeed, I'm sure there has been, and not only that, I think people are really, it's a sad situation for relationships between South Korea and China, seeing as the president of South Korea recently made her state visit and was received well and spoke in Mandarin. So seeing how the relationship between the two goes on as to how the South Korean news agencies will cover this and how China will see it will be interesting to watch.
And Aisha, I just want to bring it back to those two young Chinese girls that were killed. Some comments on Weibo, the Chinese social networking site. Some people actually have been expressing comments that have been critical of these two young girls, namely because they came from quite relatively wealthy middle-class backgrounds. They were being sent to summer camp at a cost of $5,000. Has there been much reaction there in Hong Kong to that argument, that this growing divide perhaps between the wealthy middle class in China and those without the money?
No, not really, because, I mean, obviously Hong Kong is somewhere which isn't necessarily going to be so immediately critical of capital success. But, yes, these two teenagers came from quite a prestigious high school. The high school is known for sending their students abroad and sending many graduates to great universities around the world. This was the first time I think this particular high school had sent any students to the, I think it's a Christian school in Southern California, just outside of L.A. So this is the first time they'd had a relationship there. It's an interesting thing to study all of these Chinese teenagers going abroad to learn English, to have a better grasp of the language, and it's a sad set of affairs. This is how it ended for these two teenagers. The rest of the students on that school trip are still in San Francisco and being cared for by the consulate there, and it's assumed they'll be sent home quite soon.
Aisha, I want to talk about pollution in China if we can, and we've talked about its problematicness, if that's a word, before, but now we have a measure of quite how problematic it is.
Indeed. I mean, if there's anything that could be said to be good to come from a bad thing in terms of pollution, possibly this is it. A new study that was published today is linking air pollution from coal burning in northern China to a lower life expectancy. Of course, that doesn't sound like a necessarily very positive thing, but scientists are saying that this comparison can be used to really study the effects of pollution on life expectancy around the world, and it would have been an impossible thing to discover from simply a scientific experiment. The reason it's been so easy to study is because the Chinese government gave free coal for fuel boilers north of the Huai River, and they stopped that in 1980, but it's meant that there's a real differentiation between how fuel was made north in northern China and southern China, and it's said that it can decrease life expectancy for up to 5.5 years than other people in southern China.
And Aisha, let's move to your final story, a bit of a light one on that. The iconic Peninsula Hotel had some a bit of bad news over the last couple of days.
Indeed. I mean, it's funny, the setting of the James Bond 60s story, The Man with the Golden Gun, there's been a little bit of a James Bond-esque theft. A thief has impersonated a guest at the Peninsula at the front desk. He went up on early hours of Sunday morning, got a key, waited for the actual guest in the room to leave, let himself in, put on some slippers and some casual clothes, and then called downstairs to say he'd forgotten the code for the safe, which led to the Peninsula opening up the safe for him and him leaving with about £3,000, a laptop and a number of bank cards. Of course, the Peninsula are not happy about this, and neither are the guests who are staying there.
It sounds like an amazing master plan, but all a little bit too easy. Why was it so easy for him?
It shouldn't have been so easy. There is, you read that kind of story and you do automatically think of the racial profiling that may or may not have been involved, especially in a city like Hong Kong. You have a huge number of Westerners and expats who don't really get stopped for ID. This man was a Westerner, it's thought. I wonder if they would have handed over the key so easily had they thought he was mainland Chinese or Filipino or Indian. I don't want to make too much of a comment, but one would assume it wouldn't have been so simple for him to have gotten into the rooms.
Aisha, thank you for bringing us up to date on three big stories and a slightly smaller but rather intriguing story at the Peninsula Hotel. Our bureau chief in Hong Kong is Aisha Spears.
Don't get any ideas, Dominic.
I won't. I mean, no more theft for me.
Well, coming up after this very short break, we'll be hitting the campaign trail in Zimbabwe as the rival parties launch their election manifestos ahead of the general election at the end of the month.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes audacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, Zimbabwe votes in 3 weeks' time, as in 2008, and in 2002 as well, Robert Mugabe will take on Morgan Tsvangirai. The campaigns launched in the past week, but they're taking place in, and I quote, an atmosphere of intimidation and violence. That's according to a new report from the RFK Centre for Justice and Human Rights.
After 5 years of sharing power with Mugabe, Tsvangirai's supporters had long expected this to be the moment he took the reins, but it isn't necessarily looking that way. Well, with 1 day left for voters to register for Election Day, we can head live now to Harare, and a journalist there covering events who asked us for us to refer to her as Linda joins us on the line. Linda, many thanks for joining us here on Midori House. Tell us the mood. The campaign launched last weekend. What's the mood there on the ground?
I think people are very excited because they really want this to happen. I know at some point political leaders like in the opposition, MDC, were saying that the ground is not level for fair play in elections. But if voters really want just this to be done and be done with, or to be done and be over with, because there's too much uncertainty, especially in the sense of the just ended government of national unity. It wasn't taking people any far. And people were getting a bit tired of it. And they are thinking that this is going to be the make or break election. So they are looking forward to it, although people are also scared of what it means in terms of being able to go out there and participate at rallies or campaigning.
Linda, we referred there to some concerns that have been raised by the RFK Centre. You've said the ground isn't level at this point politically. What about journalistically? You've asked us to call you, Linda. How difficult is it for journalists to operate at this point?
It is still very difficult for journalists because, look, one, journalists find it very difficult to cover if you are an independent journalist. It's difficult to cover ZANU-PF rallies. It's difficult to cover ZANU-PF meetings because you are looked at with suspicion. But what has also happened in the past few weeks is that some journalists also, even from the independent media, have been attacked also by the MDCT supporters. So it makes it very difficult for journalists to operate. It's a dangerous environment to operate for journalists, because politicians actually just like you to write what's good about them. They don't want you to be analytical. You find there's a situation where some journalists are viewed more favorably because maybe they write things that a particular party likes. But if you write something that's analytical of that political party, they might not like you. So it becomes very difficult for journalists.
And Linda, just finally, very quickly, you said there in your comments that many Zimbabweans are viewing this election as make or break. Do you think that more Zimbabweans are viewing this election as an election that could potentially break the country?
I think so. You know, if you go to, you know, today is the last day for voter registration. I've been to a voter registration centers, and lots of people really want to vote because they want to put an end to this. They want to have a government that they can say, this is the government. But those who are looking for change also want a government that they believe will bring in change. So people are determined to go out and vote.
Linda, on the line from Harare, thanks a lot for joining us. Well, for some analysis on what we can expect in 3 weeks' time, pleased to say we're joined by Monocle's Georgina Godwin, Zimbabwean journalist with a long history with the country. Georgina, welcome to Midori House. How
are you? It's lovely to be actually on a different microphone.
I know.
It's the other side of the table.
Very strange. How does it look from over there? Good?
No, it's quite scary, actually.
With us leering at you.
Don't worry, we'll be gentle. So give us your picture for how things are set up here. Clearly, there's concern from around the world and there's concern within the country for what's going to happen. I guess from an international perspective, the question is, really? Is it really still this much of a contest? Mugabe's been in power for so long. He has this sort of, perplexing relationship with the rest of the world. Is he really going to be able to hold on to power?
You know, I think he's going to do his very, very best to try and do that. In the past, we Zimbabweans have been, or Zimbabwe, the country, has had, there have been various backstops. So you've got the Commonwealth, which then Zimbabwe left. You've got SADC, which is the Southern African Development Corporation, which was the body which brokered the whole coalition agreement, made sure that actually the government of national unity could exist. And now that SADC is saying, actually, we'd like to send in election monitors and make sure that there is a level playing field here. Mugabe, in his first election speech on Friday, has said, you know what? We don't want to be a part of SADC. If SADC is insisting on these things, we'll just leave. He also called the main facilitator, a woman, a streetwalker, and said that she was very stupid.
Idiotic woman. That's what he called her.
So, I mean, as well as obviously alienating anybody who wants to see fair play, he's alienated, you know, every single woman in the country, Zanu-PF or not. So the point is that from an international point of view, he doesn't care. Really, he'll just carry on. And if there are international bodies saying you can't do that, then he just wants nothing more to do with it. You know, we need a lot of funds to run the election. The United Nations offered those funds, but said in return that there needed to be election monitors, international election monitors. The funds have been refused, and obviously so have the monitors.
But on first glance, for an observer looking at the situation, you could see, you know, there's a new constitution, there is a reformed security sector within the country, and then, of course, you do have the Southern African development community there. What went so terribly wrong then?
There is a new constitution on paper. The security section has not been reformed at all, and that's why people are very, very unhappy. Because on paper, as you say, they should have been, absolutely. But the top brass in the army and the police and the military have all made it very, very clear that they won't take orders from anybody who doesn't have liberation war credentials, i.e. Mugabe and his cohorts, and that they won't respect anybody who isn't ZANU-PF. So the security force is very much in control. There is pre-voting going on, which means that if you're a member of the military, you can vote in advance. We're told that these people have been told completely how to vote. Obviously, those votes are going in one direction only. In terms of gerrymandering, it's been done already. They've got a long history of it. Mugabe knows how to do it. He will just do it again, I'm very much afraid to say.
So where does that leave Morgan Tsvangirai, who sort of tried to play by the rules last time? We saw the difficulties that unfolded, has had this sort of waiting period of 5 years. What can he and his sort of coalition allies do at this point?
You know, in 2008, he withdrew from the presidential runoff because it got so horribly, horribly violent. The waters were muddied further by the fact that there was a third presidential candidate who got 8% of the vote, whose name's Simba Mokoni with the MKD party. And so what's just been announced yesterday is that Tsvangirai and MKD and Mokoni will form this loose coalition, which actually, I think, is going to give us a better result, because suddenly that vote won't be split. People who just want to vote for the opposite, they just don't want to vote for ZANU-PF, they'll vote for anybody but ZANU-PF, who might have voted for MKD, all those votes will now go to the MDC. There is another coalition too, so the vote could potentially be split three ways, but it's a much, much smaller party. So I think that there is possibly a lot more hope than we've seen previously, but Zimbabweans are very disillusioned. As Linda says, though, we just want it to be over. It's enough now.
But how damaged? Let's talk about Morgan Tsvangirai here. How damaged Is he politically? If you look at the polls, essentially they're in a dead heat right now, 52-51 or whatever it is. You know, lots of stories about his love life, his personal life have hurt him at the polls. Do they need a leading opposition figure? Do they need someone else?
You know, I think firstly a word about polls. People in Zimbabwe are so intimidated. If somebody with a clipboard comes and asks you your opinion, you're going to tell them the one that you think that they want to hear. We really have had the crap beaten out of us, you know, and that's how I don't think the polls are particularly reliable. In terms of Tsvangirai's personal life, you know, Mugabe himself has had a very checkered history, fathering several children before his late wife actually died. And I think that people don't particularly care about that. Tsvangirai perhaps was never meant to be presidential material. He was a union leader. He was formed the party for a short sprint. It's been a marathon. He may not be the right person to be the next leader, but he and maybe the one who comes after him will be the one that finally leads the country into the place where it would like to be. But he's certainly been a fantastic fighter. He's been a brilliant person to have at the helm to lead people through this very, very stormy time.
Excellent stuff. Georgina Godwin there, many thanks for joining us here in Studio One, and I'm sure we'll be catching up with you before the end of the month is out. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, for those of you who wonder what climate change might sound like, someone has mastered a whole symphony about it. Well, one composer there in the United States thinks he may have cracked it. Daniel Crawford from the University of Missouri has composed a musical score in which each note corresponds to a temperature point on the thermometer over the course of some 130 years.
So as the global temperature has risen, so do the notes in the symphony. Well, Daniel Crawford spoke to Monocle's Thomas Lewis a little while ago and explained how mathematics and music technology helped him transpose the shifting temperature of our warming planet into music.
Well, this was really a collaborative work between Professor St. George and myself. I actually work as an intern in his dendrochronology lab dealing with the science of tree rings. And he knew from my resume that I have quite a background in music. I've played the cello for most of my life. So he came to me and sort of tasked me with making this idea of his come to life. So he said, I want to turn the set of climate data into a musical piece, come up with a way to do that.
And how did you come up with a way to do that? Describe to us what the end product is.
Right. Well, the end product is essentially a musical time series. So each note in the piece represents a year of time, and the lower notes on the register of the cello are cooler years in temperature. And as the notes get higher and higher, the temperature of the earth warms. The data goes all the way back to the late 1800s, so there's a period of about 40 or 50 years where the notes are rather consistently low. But then as the Industrial Revolution carries on and more cars continue to be driving on the road, these new sources of greenhouse gases happen, and as a result, the climate starts to warm, and it starts to warm rather rapidly. And that's pretty evident when you can hear it in the piece.
And just describe to us what the piece sounds like, would you say?
As far as music goes, it's very amelodic. It doesn't sound pretty. But at the heart of it, it's just data. And what probably the most important aspect of the piece is, hearing the progression of the notes and keeping in mind that it's representing change in time. As I was talking about the piece, it does start out very low and with these low, sort of varying notes. And as it carries on, it starts to change into the higher register of the cello. And as it gets even closer to modern day, it starts to change even more rapidly to the point where it starts to sound a bit haunting, if you will.
And if you could describe to us the process that you went through, the maths, if you like, of transferring this climate data onto a musical score, how did you go about transposing that?
That was a bit of a creative process. I had to sort of arbitrarily select musical range to use. So I just decided to choose three octaves on my cello. And then, just to make things kind of simple, I set coolest year on record as the lowest note on my cello. And then moved up from there in a way so that the highest note on record would be exactly 3 octaves above the lowest starting note. And then you had sort of this key, if you will, for exactly how much of a change in temperature is required to move up one note and then to the next note and so forth.
And the trajectory that you've found so far is an undeniably upward one. If you carried on, or if you came back to this in, say, 50 years' time and wanted to add to your score, what would you expect the notation on that score would look like?
The notation would be rather illegible, and I don't even believe that on my instrument it would be able to go that high. And in fact, not necessarily the 50 years, but taking projections from 100 years, if the Earth is to continue warming by upwards of a degree Celsius, then using this key that I've generated for my cello, the notes would be out of the range of human hearing.
And just finally and briefly, what do you say your composition does in terms of adding to our understanding of the warming of our planet?
Well, it's a different way to represent the data that shows us that climate change is happening. And both Professor St. George and myself, we feel like there are still a lot of people who don't really understand the immediacy of this problem. And as climate scientists, we tend to have a standard toolbox for communicating our data and our methods through maps and graphs and numbers about the climate. But when we transform this data into sound and make it read like a piece of music, then it seems like we're adding another tool to that toolbox, this tool of turning music into sound. Hopefully, hearing this data represented as music will hit home with some of those people who don't necessarily get the message from the typical means we communicate climate change.
And that was Monocle's Thomas Lewis there speaking to composer Daniel Crawford. Don, do you think he's a 21st century Mozart?
I think Mozart didn't quite use the same mathematics to put things together.
What about the melodies? Were you
it's a different approach. I'm actually quite a fan of a more minimalist type of I mean, given the choice between Philip Glass and Beethoven, I'm on the glassy end of the spectrum every time.
I'm more of a Beethoven guy.
I guess that about you,
actually. Lots of triads and allegros. And
you like a bit of histrionics, don't you? That's right. Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we will leaf through the European front pages. We'll speak to our correspondent in Istanbul, and we'll hear how one corner of Jakarta is fast becoming an enclave for contemporary design. But before all of that, Paul Osborne's here with your news headlines.
A leaked Pakistani government report highlights incompetence and negligence, which it says allowed Osama bin Laden to live undetected in the country for almost a decade. It found no evidence that officials inside government were complicit in concealing bin Laden's whereabouts, but did question why earlier US concerns that he could be in the country were dismissed. Egypt's interim president set out a timetable for new elections, as unrest continues following the military's move to oust Mohamed Morsi. At least 51 people died in violence in the capital, Cairo, on Monday. Adli Mansour's plan calls for changes to Egypt's constitution and elections early next year. It could be several days before search teams in Canada can get to the entire disaster zone where a train carrying crude oil derailed and exploded in Quebec. 13 people are now confirmed dead after the explosion in Lac Megantic, but officials have warned that around 40 other people are still missing. Japan says it faces an increasingly serious threat to its security from China and North Korea. A new report says the military needs to improve its ability to respond to foreign threats. And the US has again warned that it could pull all its troops out of Afghanistan next year. Initial plans included a small force remaining to support Afghan troops when international combat forces withdraw. But officials have admitted that relations between the US and Afghanistan have worsened since America moved to start peace talks with the Taliban. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, in this week's episode of Section D, we swing by the Beautiful Shop kiosk in New York City for a surprising poetry reading. We'll also talk 3D photo imaging with artist Mark Diamond. And in the Spanish city of Seville, we take shade under Jürgen Meyer H's stunning Metropole parasol and assess the impact it's had on the city.
But in this preview, we're heading to Indonesia. And when it comes to high-end design, developing nations in Asia might not be the first to spring to mind, but a hip new enclave in Jakarta is proving otherwise. Kate Lamb meets designer and entrepreneur Leonard Theosobrata, one of the innovative minds now spearheading a creative industry from scratch.
You graduate from Arts Center Pasadena, a breeding ground for the doyens of product designers in the US. Then you get offered a job at a studio that designs for Apple. And you take it, right? Well, maybe not, if you think like Indonesian entrepreneur Leonard Theosobrata.
I wanted to do much more than that. I guess I always have like a bigger goal in life. And at the time, I quickly realized that I can't work for anybody. Like, because I did work for somebody for like a year as a graphic designer. And my life was really miserable. And, like, literally, I was miserable.
Theosobrata returned home in 2002 with an ambitious mission. Develop a world-class furniture brand made in Indonesia. Rather than follow in his father's woodworking footsteps, he spent his evenings in a hot, mosquito-ridden factory learning how to weld and bend metal. It was here that he set the groundwork for his brand Acupunto, which fuses the principles of Eastern acupuncture with Western functionality.
It's a furniture that is based from a system. We call it ergonomic, like human body support structure. You know, like the way it was designed, it was to support and to form your contour so that it makes you feel comfortable. And it was based on a grid of this connected pins, modules on a elastic cord.
Think clean, modernist lines meet a bed of enlarged, bendy Lego. It's a fun and unique product that is now internationally awarded and patented. But at the time, the Indonesian designer says that people couldn't believe it wasn't made in Italy or Germany, and that this kind of reaction was common.
Branding from Indonesia, are you kidding me? You know, like that kind of mentality.
Theosobrata says attitudes have changed exponentially since the early 2000s, with Indonesian and regional designers making their mark on the global stage.
Especially with what's happening in the Western Hemisphere, you know, like all of a sudden this world is turning upside down. Asia is like on the rise, you know, and it's not just a media thing, it's real.
Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono is in an enviable position. He has Asia's third fastest growing economy.
It was in the context of this dynamic growth that the idea for a New York-style curated market was first bandied about. Theosobrata and his friends convinced, and in some cases begged, 25 local designers to take part.
It was successful from day one. And then we just keep evolving that. And then the last one, it was attracted almost 80,000 people in the course of 4 days. But for us, we quickly realized that, you know, this is kind of like the stepping stone for a permanent store.
A collaboration between Theosobrata and four of his friends. The Bright Spot Market evolved into a hip store called the Goods Department in 2010. And it has almost single-handedly revolutionized the local fashion and design scene here.
I don't really know like where to stand as a brand before. And then we joined Bright Spot Market, and then it turns out there's like a huge target market for Nikichu. And then it was pretty like eye-opener for me. And then after that, the Good Step opened, and then we joined, and then, you know, put our stuff there and everything. And then it's getting more well-known year by year, day by day.
That's local designer, 28-year-old Nina Nikishio, speaking from a bustling Jakarta cafe. Her brand Nikishio and its classically cut high-end construction pieces is one of the most successful labels at the boutique store. She says Indonesian consumers are buying more and more local designs, But she still gets excited when she sees her cuts out and about town.
Even until now, when I see like some strangers wearing Nikichi, I'll be like so happy and giddy and stuff. And then, they are starting to appreciate, because before it's very hard for you to sell clothes more than $200, for example, here locally, because they will say that, you know, it's local product, it should be cheap. And then it's starting to change now. They appreciate quality more. They started to know why we have that price instead of, you know, like $10.
It's the same conundrum Theo Sobrato found himself in years ago when he was marketing his furniture internationally. He says watching the design scene here totally explode is a beautiful thing. Kids in their early 20s, right out of school, becoming sophisticated, savvy designers.
But I think it's still very exciting, you know, like it's very exciting to see we created this industry, you know, like, or we helped to create this new industry, you know, which is like cool fashion, ready to wear, Indonesian, you know, which there was only one brand before.
For Monocle from the New World, this is Kate Lamb in Jakarta.
And you can hear more from the world of international design on the latest edition of Section D later today at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House, the latest from Gezi Park, when we speak to our correspondent in Istanbul right after this.
Join us at midday London time every weekday for The Briefing, Monocle 24's fast-paced hour-long roundup of global breaking news stories, in-studio analysis, and a first look at the North American front pages. And for those waking up on the East Coast, it's the perfect way to get a Monocle take on the stories you need to know at the start of each day. The Briefing, live at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York and 6 a.m. in Chicago.
You're listening to Midori House, 8:41 here in London, and it's time to check in with Caleb Lauer. He's our man in Istanbul with the stories making the headlines there. Caleb, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Thank you very much. Let's talk about Gezi Park. It's official opening, but it didn't last long. What happened?
Yes, it was a very odd opening day for Gezi Park. The governor of Istanbul was on hand to reopen the park after about a month, more than a month of it being closed due to the protests that most people will be familiar with. Now, yesterday afternoon it was opened for 3 hours. The governor made a speech along with the mayor of Istanbul, etc. But because of the protesters also attended the opening, the police decided to reclose the park and disperse the crowd, which led to basically about 6 hours of what we've seen again and again in the center of Istanbul over the last 6 weeks: tear gas, water cannon, rubber bullets. But oddly, they reopened the park again last night at about midnight. So all last night it was opened after this essentially futile street battle between protesters and police, and it's open as we speak.
So are there protesters gathered there now in Gezi Park?
There's a press conference that is happening right now as we speak at a hotel right across from Gezi Park. So following that press conference, there will be some sort of movement towards the park, and we'll see what happens today.
Caleb, when I was there last month, it was filled with a sort of festival-style atmosphere and various people sort of enjoying the life of actually living there in the park. To what degree was it cleaned up, and to what degree is it returning to the state that it was in a month ago?
It has been completely transformed. In May, for example, it was essentially a half construction site, half police cordoned off area, half police headquarters, etc., and construction site. Since the police cleared Gezi Park on June 15th, they have been working 24 hours basically to landscape this thing into a picture of perfect pristineness. In one regard, it's quite beautiful now, but it's, as the protesters will tell you, it's been dehumanized. It's so nice.
Caleb, can you move the story forward for us? What's going to happen now? Are we expecting these protesters to continue, their angry chants against Erdogan, or do we see this kind of dispersing in the coming weeks?
Well, there's, there's a few things that needs to be said about that. The tear gas story is unfortunately taking the focus off much of what's been happening beyond the headlines or behind the headlines, let's say. There's been very, very positive things happening that will have an effect in the future. One of them are these forums that take place in every park across the city and in many other cities in Turkey. These are citizen-oriented forums where people come together to share their ideas. And the people that attend these forums are really, really enthusiastic about the positive changes that these things are going to bring. For example, people are saying, you know, for the first time, I feel like I have an effect or I can have an effect on local politics. And that's an extraordinary thing to say for a country that claims to be a democracy, that people living in a neighborhood can actually, for the first time, feel they have an effect. So that's a very, very positive thing that will continue. The negative stuff that we don't see because of the focus on the tear gas and the fights with the water cannon is that there is a very sinister thing happening. People are being arrested every day. You know, every morning we wake up to news of 10, 20, 30 new people being arrested on charges of you know, being provocateurs or whatever. A magazine has recently been closed because it dared to put on its cover part of the story of Gezi Park. Doctors are being persecuted for volunteering and helping injured people. Now, these things don't make the international media, but they're very, very significant. And all of this points to what's going to happen in about 7 or 8 months, which is going to be the real contest and the real outcome of this struggle is going to be determined in the local elections that are scheduled for early 2014. People are very, very conscious that these elections in early 2014 will essentially declare a verdict on this mass mobilization of society.
Caleb, moving on to another story, given how central the perceived Islamification of Turkey was to the Gezi Park protests, I wonder how has what's happened in the last week in Egypt been received in Turkey? What's the response to Mohamed Morsi's ousting?
Well, this has been really a traumatic thing for the Turkish government, the coup d'etat in Egypt. In terms of foreign policy, it affects Turkey's plans quite significantly. Morsi was a key ally, and there was plans for a Turkish-Egyptian alliance in the eastern Mediterranean. This also sort of complicates Turkey's policy towards Syria. But the real trauma or the real drama is how this is received domestically. One of the things that is that should be said about the AK Party, the government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is that it is vehemently anti-coup d'etat. Turkey has had coup d'etats since 1960. There's 1960, 1971, 1980, and 1997. And the 1997 coup d'etat was a direct attack against political Islam, from which many of the people that support or are members of the AK Party come from. So this what's happened to Morsi is felt almost viscerally by people here who self-identify with political Islam, not necessarily because they are great fans of Morsi or the Muslim Brotherhood, but because of what they are themselves. The Gezi Park protest, much of the rhetoric that the government was using was subtly suggesting that the Gezi Park protesters were essentially supporters of a coup d'etat against the government. And what the Gezi Park protests wanted was some sort of a coup d'etat against the government. So what's happened in Egypt is a very, very, tragic and dramatic demonstration of what some of the greatest fears of the AK Party, are in terms of its relations in domestic politics in Turkey.
And Caleb, finally, you have another story for us, and the word is dysfunction. Tell us about that.
Yes. Recently in the Turkish Parliament, there was a vote on a very, very sort of innocuous law. It was these things are put in what's called a bag law in Turkish, torba kanunu, which means just everything goes in it, and they vote one by one, on these. On these clauses. And what happened was that the opposition party raised their hand to support it, and so the governing party did not support it as a reflex to seeing the hands of the opposition go up. But in fact, it was their own law that they had voted down, proposed by themselves. Clearly they didn't read what they were voting on, and they voted in pure reflex and response to what the opposition had done. And this points to basically something that isn't talked about enough in terms of Turkish politics, that one of the biggest criticisms of Erdogan is that he's too authoritarian. But one of the real sort of fundamental facts of Turkish politics is that the prime ministry is the only institution that functions properly. The courts don't function properly. The parliament doesn't function properly. The media, the opposition party, none of these organs for a healthy democracy function at all. So the criticism of Erdogan that he's too authoritarianism should be seen in the light of the fact that most other political institutions in Turkey do not function as they should.
Caleb, an interesting picture you paint for us there. Thanks very much. Our man in Istanbul is Caleb Lauer. Thanks for joining us.
Now, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to have a look at the European front pages. But before we do, we have time for a quick song. Here is France's own Naive New Beaters from Paris. This is La Onda. And from Paris, that was the trio there. That was Naive New Beaters with La Onda.
Now you're listening to Midori House with Phil Hahn and Dominic Reynolds. It's time to look at the front pages in Europe. To help us do that, Alexa Firmenich is here. Hello, Alexa.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? You're looking very summery.
Thank you. The sun is shining.
Yeah, I like it.
I mean, Phil, I would say you're actually looking a little bit scruffy today.
Oh.
I'm just saying.
You're wearing sharp yellow pants. Let's not go there.
Okay, so Le Monde first up, Alexa. What's interesting in Le Monde for you today?
So there is an interesting editorial piece that talks about the upcoming elections in Mali on the 28th of July. And basically what they're saying is that it's too much too soon. The country has just, they just lifted a state of emergency on Saturday. And it was 6 months after France's military intervention. And they're already saying, within a few weeks, the whole country will be having elections.
There's an interesting line in that editorial. It says, elections are not democracy. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what they're trying to get across with that statement.
Well, I mean, in this particular case, at least, the lists aren't ready. The ballots aren't distributed. There's 500,000 of the citizens that aren't even in the country right now or that are displaced. So at the end of the day, what voices are going to be heard won't necessarily be the voices of the people.
Okay, and Le Monde presumably will have quite a lot of sway with that piece. It's interesting to see it put so prominently as that election date approaches.
Well, I'm quite interested. Is this, obviously the French had such an involvement in this conflict. Is this still something that resonates with people across France? Is this still something that's atop of their agenda when it comes to foreign policy?
Well, I mean, I think that what a lot of people do say is that the French really did save Mali when they stepped in this time around. And they waited for a while, but then when they stepped in, they really did oust. And they did help a lot of the cities. So I think that the French have a feeling of maybe pride and also indebtedness. I mean, they feel like they need to be there to help them through this transition, even though they are planning to withdraw most of their troops after the elections.
Well, that's it. And it, the better things go in Mali, the better it looks for François Hollande.
Exactly,
and the more his global statesman credentials are burnished, I suppose. What else has caught your eye this morning, Alexa?
So now I'm going closer to home. There's the Tribune de Genève. And over the weekend, China and Switzerland signed a free trade agreement, which is actually China's first with a country in continental Europe. So, I mean, this is great for Switzerland. China is a very big market for us in terms of our luxury goods, like our watches, our pharmaceuticals. And also,
you say us, you are a Swiss person.
I'm Swiss.
It's clear. There we go.
Not Chinese.
It's actually waving a Swiss flag, but unfortunately with radio it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, carry on.
And Switzerland's actually a very important tourist destination for the Chinese as well. They have, we have special travel agencies even set up to accommodate the Chinese. So this is an important step. But what this Swiss political scientist is saying is that he's comparing this to the EU-US talks that are taking place. Mm. And he's saying actually he doubts it's going to be constructive between the US and EU. And there are quite a few sticking points, right, which are sort of France wants to protect its culture. There's a lot of talk about the agricultural policies between the EU and the US. I mean, the Europe always feels a little bit superior when it comes to their food in terms of, you know, the quality. And
well, I just want to touch on that point and get the Swiss perspective, because you mentioned they have close ties. Lots of Chinese go to Switzerland. In the past, you know, couple months, we've heard stories of Chinese companies actually taking over some very traditional Swiss companies. How are people in Switzerland reacting to this, you know, this involvement from the Chinese? Are they happy with it?
I mean, there's apprehension, but something that I think a lot of Swiss people do have faith in, which is quite unique, is we do trust our politicians to sort of look after us. It's a small country, and anything that we're not happy with, we can sort of bring it to the polls. So we're watching, but I haven't heard that much rhetoric, honestly, about food safety concerns.
Okay. Before you go, let's go tabloid.
Let's go tabloids.
You're clutching a Swiss tabloid. What's going on the 20 minutes, I guess?
20 minutes in the German parts. It says, drones are threatening our private lives.
Dun, 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 dun.
And there's this piece by, it doesn't even really say who.
Doesn't matter. It's just a threat.
And people are getting worried about drones and their potential to invade on people's private lives by attaching GPS and small cameras and, in effect, being used to spy on neighbours. And
I mean, you know, obviously it's been covered in a very tabloid way, but it is a story of the utmost seriousness. And I suppose as, you know, as the technology evolves, people begin to wonder where these things can't go, you know?
I mean, it's true. And actually, in France, you need apparently you need a pilot's theoretical license to even be able to fly a drone. So, you know, maybe we'll see that happening in more places.
Maybe they'll let me fly a drone somewhere.
I would say if there is an international list of people who are allowed to fly drones, I would campaign viciously for you not to be on it, Phil. Not to be on the drone flying list,
I think that would actually fulfill one of my lifelong goals.
Yeah?
Because I was saying I never had one of those model airplanes that you could fly around.
But Phil, you did have a helicopter. Well,
that's deprived childhood.
Alexa Primish, many thanks for leading us through the European front pages today. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have. Thanks to our producer, Thomas Lewis, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Tess McCann, and the lovely studio manager, Jack Phillips. Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. I'll be back with Tom Edwards for tomorrow's edition of Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.